Iran says its ambassador to Yemen has passed away due to COVID complications because certain countries delayed his return home for medical treatment. Moscow and Washington engage in security talks over Russia's demand that NATO stop putting military troops and hardware near its border. Also in the headlines, New Zealand shelves plans for the reopening of its borders over concerns that the Omicron COVID variant is spreading fast across the globe. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Yemen ambassador Hassan Irlou has passed away due to complications from COVID-19. Tehran says the envoy could not receive timely medical treatment because certain countries delayed his evacuation from Yemen. Here's a look at his profile.
Hassan Irlou was born in 1959 in Shahrareh, a small town near Tehran. After the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, he joined the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was a veteran of the Iran-Iraq War and had been suffering from complications of chemical attacks. Irlou went on to become a senior diplomat. After Yemen's conflict broke out in 2015, he was transferred to Department for Yemen's Affairs at Iran's Foreign Ministry, where he served as deputy assistant to the minister. During that period, Irlou coordinated the transfer of Iranian humanitarian aid to Yemen, in cooperation with the United Nations. In October 2020, he was appointed as Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government. In that portfolio, Irlou focused his efforts on unifying resistance groups and strived for national reconciliation. He encouraged Yemeni political groups to resolve their internal disputes through dialogue. The senior diplomat also worked towards garnering international support for mechanisms that would end the Yemen conflict and lift the blockade imposed by the Saudi military coalition. Irlou was diagnosed with COVID-19 days before he was transferred to Tehran from Sana'a to receive medical treatment. But by the time he arrived at a hospital in Iran's capital on Sunday, his condition had worsened irrevocably. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that's because certain countries delayed his flight out of Sana'a. Khatibzadeh did not name any specific country, but Saudi Arabia and its allies in the war have been keeping Yemen under a blockade since 2015. The main airport in Sana'a has been closed for more than 5 years now. Hassan Irlou passed away on Tuesday morning due to complications from COVID-19. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has expressed its condolences to Tehran.
Saudi warplanes carry out 3 airstrikes on Sana'a International Airport as the kingdom intensifies its war on Yemen. Yemen's Civil Aviation Authority says the strikes have disrupted services at the airport. It says that there has been a halt to the delivery of humanitarian aid supplies following the air raids. The airport was targeted hours after Saudi warplanes reportedly carried out around 40 airstrikes across the provinces of Jowf and Marib. Riyadh, along with some of its regional allies, launched a devastating war against a southern neighbor in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed in the onslaught. Our correspondent Abdulatif Al-Washali says the airstrikes on Sana'a International Airport would only hamper the delivery of humanitarian aid and worsen the crisis in Yemen.
They are targeting the airport and they will get nothing from these attacks. They have been attacking the airport for 7 years now. They achieved nothing. The flights that use the airport are only the flights of the UN and the international organizations. Some of them are for aid and assistance for the Yemeni people. This will hamper the work of the international organizations working in Yemen. This will only worsen the situation in the country. The humanitarian situation is really bad. Saudi Arabia is only destroying the infrastructure of the country. They are not going to get anything from attacking the airports, the hospitals, or all the civilian facilities of the country. They are only destroying the rights of the people to use the international airport, to travel abroad for the treatment. We have thousands of patients who can't travel abroad for the treatment. Most of them are children. They die every day because they don't have even a chance to use their airport to go to other countries.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps is holding the second day of large-scale military drills in the south of the country. The IRGC's naval forces have successfully fired anti-ship cruise missiles, destroying mock enemy vessels. They also flew assault drones to destroy fixed and mobile targets. Five-day maneuvers, codenamed the Great Prophet 17, are underway in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz regions, as well as the coasts of Hormuzgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan. The provinces, that is. The drills involve a variety of IRGC units. Iran regularly holds military drills to enhance the combat readiness of its armed forces. The commander of the IRGC's naval forces, Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsiri, says that all the weapons used in the drills were made in Iran.
The drills, codenamed the Great Prophet 17, is being conducted in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz by the IRGC. One of the areas IRGC forces today are protecting is the Nasiat Islands. As you saw, we are fully prepared defense. Our forces on the island destroyed mock enemy targets trying to attack their positions, and no fixed or mobile targets were able to reach the island. This shows their operational power. All the weapons and equipment used in today's drills, including missiles, are made in Iran. Our capabilities are increasing every year. Compared to last year's drills, our forces were more prepared and their weapons have been upgraded.
Iran has called on the international community to help improve the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan and to stop the flow of refugees. It says it does not have the capacity to provide additional services to incoming refugees. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guests. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The Iranian foreign minister says that his country does not have the capacity to provide additional services to incoming Afghan refugees. According to Hossein Amir Abdullahian, more than 500,000 Afghan students are enjoying free education in Iran. He said that authorities have been vaccinating Afghan refugees and Iranian nationals alike against COVID-19. He noted that the United Nations aid for Afghan asylum seekers is too small compared to what Iran has provided for them. Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a meeting with the UN's Visiting High Commissioner for Refugees. He called on the international community to help improve the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan in order to stop the flow of refugees. Thousands of Afghans have been crossing into Iran on a daily basis since the Taliban took over the country in August. Elijah Magnier is a journalist and political analyst joining us from Brussels. We also have Hossein Askari, board member at the Belt and Road Institute in Sweden, who joins us from Stockholm. I'd like to welcome you both. Now, let me first start with you, Hossein Askari. You have Iran obviously saying that this influx is not something that Iran can sustain or maintain in terms of the service that it's giving Afghans. It's already done quite a bit throughout the decades, really, when you really look at this closely. So given that Iran has voiced its concern that it's not going to accommodate these Afghan refugees, what can the international community do? Do you expect them to reciprocate this call and do something about it?
Thank you very much for inviting me. I think it was made very, very clear by both Mr. Abdullahian and also the other Muslim foreign ministers in the conference of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation in Islamabad on Sunday, where it was very clearly declared that in Iran and Pakistan, who have taken the largest numbers of Afghan refugees throughout the years and provided them with actually good services, but that these two countries cannot take any more refugees, and that the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan has to be dealt with in a different way. And I think it was also made clear by both Prime Minister Imran Khan but other officials that the Western world has a moral and practical obligation to not abandon Afghanistan after 20 years of the war they had launched there which is actually the cause of this crisis. It's not the Taliban takeover. But the first step that should be taken now by the United States and the Western countries is to unfreeze the $9.5 billion in Afghani money. These are money that belong to the Afghan people, not to Taliban. They are frozen in American and European banks, and this money can immediately be used to relieve the Afghan people by food, medicine, and other necessary, including buying electricity, paying for electricity and other services which come from the neighboring country, ironically from Iran, which is under harsh American sanctions, but still can provide both for its people and for the Afghan refugees a relatively decent living standard and services. So there is an obligation now, and our Schiller, I work also for the Schiller Institute, we have a campaign in the United States and in Europe to push politicians, especially in Congress, and now there are many members of Congress have sent a letter to the Biden administration on this question. So there should be more work done to force or to urge the United States and Europe to do their share and to mitigate this crisis.
Okay, so here comes the hard question, Elijah Magnier. Is the U.S. in particular, and maybe the West overall, weaponizing the issue of refugees, of Afghans flowing into Iran in order to, I guess, somehow affect Iran or impact Iran? Because we know that ultimately this is something that, in a certain degree, needs economic accommodations, which Iran is providing, which no longer it says it can do. So is this perhaps a way that this is being weaponized, so to speak, by the U.S. perhaps against Iran?
Thank you for having me. Indeed, yes. When we have around 4,000 to 5,000 Afghan crossing daily the borders into Iran, when there are over more than 3 million Afghan refugees in the country, and we have very little money coming from the United Nations, even a percentage of the money allocated is coming to Iran to support the refugees, we see that Turkey is receiving $6 billion a year to support 1.7 refugee only, we understand there is something fundamentally wrong. Now, the Afghan refugees need a lot of water daily, and they need food, they need accommodation. The winter is extremely harsh with the continued flow of refugee in Iran. All that represents a huge economic burden on the country, on the infrastructure, on the accommodation, on everything. In the time when the U.S. is tightening its control over the sanctions and trying to prevent Iran from having even humanitarian support, particularly during the COVID crisis that is still going on. So I think the Americans are using this kind of wicked weapon of refugees against Iran to increase the pressure on Iran and not to relieve it from additional pressure that the already economy is causing the government, and that is not yet resolved during the Vienna talk. And we see Biden increasing the sanctions rather than decreasing it. All that creates indeed a very big pressure on Iran economy, and it is weaponized by the United States of America.
Thank you very much for that, Elijah Magnier. We appreciate it. Journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Hossein Askari, a pleasure. Board member at Belt and Road Institute in Sweden. Thank you so much. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in. Russia and the United States have just started their discussions on the security guarantees that Moscow is seeking against NATO's eastward expansion. Senior security negotiator Konstantin Gavrilov says an understanding between Moscow and Washington on the issue is possible. Moscow is demanding written guarantees that NATO will not expand further east in former Soviet republics. Russia has also massed military equipment at the border with Ukraine, but it says the purpose is defensive amid Ukraine's push to join NATO. Earlier we were joined by author and researcher Greg Simmons. He cast doubt on the possibility of Russia reaching a meaningful agreement with the U.S. and NATO on the existing security concerns.
There's no point in looking at the issue that NATO and the U.S. are separate. The U.S. calls the shots in NATO, and They have been continually violating promises stemming from the promise to Gorbachev, which Matlock, the former ambassador to the USSR, has stated on many occasions. And if we look at it contemporarily, US promises and guarantees and even signed treaties and negotiations mean nothing. I mean, Iran knows this with the JCPOA, the different nuclear treaties which have been violated by the United States unilaterally. So these are worthless, and I doubt that they will actually make any agreement.
More drama unfolding in a tit-for-tat diplomacy between Beijing and Washington. Based on a new decision, members of the U.S. Religious Commission will not be allowed to step into China. China's foreign ministry says four people from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom are facing the ban. These individuals will be barred from entering not only the mainland, but also Hong Kong and Macau. Their assets in China will be frozen, and they will not be allowed to deal with Chinese citizens and institutions. Earlier this month, the U.S. slapped sanctions against a number of Chinese people and entities for alleged human rights abuses targeting Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. Beijing says those accusations are not true, and Washington needs to correct its mistakes. These retaliatory measures add up to previous tensions over trade, Taiwan, and the COVID origins. The rapid spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus is affecting the year-end holiday plans around the world. In the latest development, New Zealand says that its borders will remain closed for longer than expected. The country was just about to ease some of its tough cross-border restrictions, but it has now postponed until the end of February. Officials say the government needed a precautionary measure against the most transmissible COVID variant yet. Air New Zealand says that the postponement to the reopening plans will affect more than 27,000 customers. So far, 22 people in the Pacific nation have been affected with Omicron, but there have been no reports of community transmissions yet. New Zealand has one of the toughest COVID-related restrictions in the world. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Elam commemoration ceremony.
Shahid ma dar vaqe mistaq va mazhar in Allah ashtara.
Our martyrs are, in fact, the manifestation of this verse. Indeed, Allah has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions for paradise to be theirs. The Holy Quran, Surah 9, verse 111. In other words, they have dealt with their lives with God. This is how martyrs are.
Ya un ayye شریفه صدقوا ما عهد الله عليه فمنهم من قضى نحبه ومنهم من ينتظر من المؤمنين رجال صدقوا ما عهد الله عليه
There is another holy verse which says, among the faithful are men who fulfill what they have pledged to Allah. Of them are some who have fulfilled their pledge, and of them are some who still wait. The Holy Quran, Surah 33, verse 23. They were true to the pledge they had made with God, the Exalted. A martyr is like this. Martyrdom is an act of making a pledge and dealing with God. That is why you see that the soldiers who are fighting in the way of God are different from other common soldiers in the world. Those of you who have witnessed the sacred defense and those of you who have read books on this topic surely know that the pious soldiers in the sacred defense, or the soldiers who have defended in other areas such as defending the holy shrines and the like, are purer during fighting and in the field of battle than at other times. They also rely more on God, show more humility, and observe the divine limits more carefully.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
در دنیا معمول است که وقتی یک لشکری پیروز میشد در یک شهری براشون قارت و چپاول و نمیدونم ظلم و این چیزا چیز عادی است اینجا نه خیر اینجا رزمنده مجاهد فی سبیل الله در میدان جنگ اگر پیروز هم بشود اخلاصش رعایت حدود الهیش اندکی کم نمیشه بلکه در حال پیروزی به خاطر شکرانه پیروزی این رعایت ها بیشتر هم میشه
It is common in the world for a victorious army to loot, plunder, and inflict great cruelty in a city. But this is not the case for our soldiers. Even if those who fight in the way of God win, not only does their piety not decrease and they do not stop observing the divine limits, they are even more careful to observe God's limits because of their gratefulness for their victory. Our soldiers would take some of the enemy captive. This was the same enemy who would torture and harass our captives from the time they took them captive up until the time they entered the camp where they were to be kept. And it is clear what they did to them in those camps. But if our soldiers took those same people captive, they would heal them if they were injured, and they would give them water if they were thirsty. They would treat them as if they were one of themselves. So, these are very important points.
I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Scores of Palestinians have been injured by Israeli settlers in villages around the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank following a shooting near an illegal outpost in Homesh that left one settler dead and two wounded. Dozens of Israeli settlers attacked Qaryut village south of Nablus overnight. The attackers broke into many homes in the town and assaulted local families. Scores of Palestinians were injured in the process and moved to several hospitals in Nablus. According to the Palestinian media, the settlers also blocked the main highway connecting Nablus and Ramallah and attacked vehicles with Palestinian license plates with the stones, causing damages to several cars. In reaction to the attacks, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates called on the United Nations to promptly activate the international protection system for Palestinian civilians under Israeli occupation. It also called on the international community to pressure the Israeli regime into stopping acts of terrorism committed by settlers against Palestinians and their communities. The ministry held the regime of Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett fully and directly responsible for settler violence and terror, and warned against the dangerous repercussions of their acts on the status of the region. It is stressed that Israeli authorities are encouraging and protecting settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. According to Israeli advocacy group B'Tselem, 2021 saw a rise in settler violence of 28.6% compared to last year. UN human rights experts have expressed alarm at the rising rate of violence directed by Israeli settlers toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of the Humanitarian Affairs, already in the first 10 months of 2021, there have been 410 attacks by settlers against Palestinians. Four Palestinians were killed by settlers this year. Nearly 700,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank. All the settlements are illegal under international law, and the United Nations Security Council has condemned the settlement activities in several resolutions. Since occupying the West Bank, Israel has misappropriated more than 200,000 hectares of land there for its own purposes, including building and expanding settlements and paving roads for settlers. Some areas have been taken over by the regime, issuing military orders, others through daily acts of settler violence. These two seemingly unrelated tracks are both forms of state violence. The Israeli apartheid regime and its representatives actively aid and abet the settlers' violence as part of his strategy to cement the takeover of Palestinian land.
The settlers and the uniformed soldiers work together, not without tensions, but they always support each other, and the settlers are used to carry out a particular kinds of attacks, burning trees, certain kinds of terror attacks, which the army prefers not to do. They shoot, they kill, but they protect the settlers 100% of the time. The settlers know this, and it gives them a sense of complete impunity.
Last week, the U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland and an Israeli minister who is responsible for police discussed the increase in settler violence against Palestinians. That drew rebukes from pro-settlement ministers and right-wing opposition lawmakers within the Israeli regime. Omer Bar-Lev later pushed back his critics, saying they were having difficulty looking in the mirror and that settler violence has become an issue on the international stage. But Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett jumped in to say it's just a marginal issue. In a tweet on Tuesday, he noted that there are marginal elements in every community, and they should be dealt with using all means, but we must not generalize about an entire community. The Combatants for Peace group, which brings together Israeli and Palestinian victims of violence, condemned Bennett for his Tuesday comments, charging that the Prime Minister had given full backing to depraved settler violence, which has reached new heights under his watch. The group added that Bennett gave a green light to the Wild West atmosphere in the territories. Also, an interview published on Wednesday revealed what Israeli Foreign Minister thinks about this issue. He told an American periodical earlier this month that extremist violence is a stain on Israel amid a noted rise in violent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians.
There is a situation in the West Bank which is lawless. You might consider the situation to be one of no legal protection for Palestinians whatsoever.
Bennett's marginalization of the issue was aimed at legitimizing and praising settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. Let's not forget that Israeli soldiers and police usually defend the attackers or simply stand to the side when they assault Palestinians. Therefore, settler violence is a central issue that requires urgent attention from the international community to put an end to it.
Morgan, Helen Margaret Lillian, Liberal Democrats, 17,957.
In another setback for the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his Conservative Party has lost its North Shropshire seat to Liberal Democrats in a by-election, the constituency the Tories dominated for nearly 200 years. In her victory speech, Helen Morgan said the results reflect the British people's views about the Conservative Party.
Tonight, the people of North Shropshire have spoken on behalf of the British people. They've said loudly and clearly, Boris Johnson, the party is over.
The Liberal Democrats, in my view, have never been an alternative to the Conservative Party. There's very little difference between the policies of the Liberal Democrats and Conservatives. In other words, when the Conservatives lose credibility, they bring out the Liberal Democrats, who are sort of centrists, never represented any concrete or coherent alternative to the Conservative Party.
Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale also says the by-election can be regarded as a referendum on the Prime Minister's performance. The by-election was called after the former MP for North Shropshire stepped down for breaching the Parliament's paid lobbying rules. The British government tried to avert the resignation by changing the rules, but later faced a backlash and was forced to backtrack. That was only one in the long list of issues raising questions about Boris Johnson's leadership. Opposition politicians accused Johnson of being a serial liar and incompetent leader, with some demanding that he resign.
Clearly, the vote in North Shropshire...
Boris Johnson acknowledged that the shocking results of the North Shropshire by-election contained a message for him and his party.
I'm responsible for everything that the government does, and of course I take personal responsibility.
But there's too much responsibility to shoulder, as Boris Johnson's tenure has been replete with a spate of allegations and scandals. The Premier stands accused of breaking the law by using Conservative Party donations to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. He's also under pressure for reported parties in his office last Christmas, disregarding the very COVID-19 restrictions the government had imposed. British dailies The Guardian and The Independent have also reported that Boris Johnson himself joined a pizza party in Downing Street in May last year, amid the first nationwide lockdown. The Premier is also under fire for his handling of the pandemic. On Tuesday, he suffered a humiliating rebellion from Conservative lawmakers over measures to curb the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. In addition, damaging disclosures have surfaced about some of the Conservative MPs who've moonlighted as political consultants or advisors, raking in tens of thousands of pounds by lobbying. The metaphorical pendulum in Britain's domestic politics appears to be swinging to the other side. The Conservatives have a couple of years to stop that from happening.
Inflation in the UK has risen to its highest level in 10 years. The cost of living has surged by 5.1% in the 12 months to November, up from 4.2% the month before. This was the steepest increase for a decade, and more than doubles the central bank's target. Increase in costs for fuel, energy, clothing, and second-hand cars were indicative of the rise in inflation. Economists had expected an inflation of 4.7% for the month of November, and the Bank of England had projected that inflation would hit 5% in the spring of 2022, before moderating towards its 2% target in late 2023.
We haven't seen inflation at this level for many decades. The highest level I can remember, actually, was back in the 1970s, when it reached 25%. So 5% is still very high, but nothing near that level. But it's still double the level that the Bank of England expected, of just over about 2.5%. And so it's going to be very difficult to try and adjust to it. Now, the question is, of course, is this going to be embedded inflation and carry on, as we saw in the 1970s, or is it just roll off after 12 months because of individual price increases?
It is believed that global supply chain problems, staff shortages, and rapid demand for oil and gas have all driven up prices. The end of COVID support schemes and Brexit
have also played a part. In November, petrol prices jumped to the highest ever recorded, while the cost of used cars jumped due to shortages of new vehicles. The UK fuel poverty has further increased due to the increase in energy costs, putting further strain on the average UK family.
And those supply chain issues take a long time to work their way through. Most recently we had, for instance, a shortage of lorry drivers, and only now we're beginning to see our way through the other side of that, so it's taken 3 or 4 months to work its way through. Other issues of supply chain will be much longer, as a lot of businesses will try and shorten their supply routes, supply chains, and de-risk their supply chains, and that means more localization, local product production, and maybe less trade coming out of, say, the Far East and other areas like that. So global trade was designed in such a way, it was like an elastic band, very efficient and very taut, but unfortunately when that elastic band breaks, it's very difficult to replace quickly.
The rising inflation has sparked an outcry from Britain's Unite trade union. It says many workers face an effective pay cut with the prospect of below-inflation annual wage increases. The Unite union has urged companies to grant pay hikes that preserve the buying power salary.
Well, what we've seen, obviously, is oil price rising, particularly gas. And unfortunately for the British public, they've got a nasty shock coming in the spring when the government-imposed cap on the gas price is taken off. And a lot of people could see their prices of gas nearly double in value, which is going to be very painful for them indeed. So this is working its way through the system. We're going to see higher wage rises coming through. And this has particularly hit people at the weaker end of society, those who are poorer paid. Well, if nothing else, it means they're going to get paid more. But unfortunately, not in real terms, because even if you get a 4% pay rise, which has been suggested for many, when you've got inflation at over 5%, you're still losing money.
Current estimates suggest that costs for the typical UK family will jump by £1,700 in the year 2022. But Labour claim the government is not doing nearly enough to tackle the problem, especially as further inflationary pressures from rising energy costs are coming down the line. Omicron, which emerged late last month, forced Britain to reimpose coronavirus restrictions that were passed by lawmakers late on Tuesday. The UK economy was already struggling prior to the arrival of Omicron, growing by 0.1% in October from 0.6% in September. The International Monetary Fund warned Tuesday that new COVID-19 variants pose downside risks to the outlook for Britain, urging the government to consider new emergency stimulus measures in the event of fresh lockdowns. The IMF predicted inflation would reach around 5.5% early next year, its highest in 30 years, and warned the bank not to succumb to inaction bias. Economists have warned that the supply chain disruptions will continue to disrupt economic activity, leading to sharp price increases at least through the year 2022. This phenomenon is not unique to just the UK. The US and many other parts of the world are also suffering from inflation, from food prices to energy costs.
Months after a chaotic end to its disastrous war in Afghanistan, failure of America's longest military mission is fueling a heated debate about U.S. militarism. The war dragged on for 2 decades and cost American taxpayers over $2.3 trillion. Thousands of American troops lost their lives, and many more were injured in the protracted military campaign that's been widely described as a fiasco. The war wreaked havoc on Afghanistan, with tens of thousands of civilians losing their lives or limbs. On August the 30th, the United States withdrew from Afghanistan after a terrible loss to the enemy it invaded Afghanistan to defeat. There is absolutely no doubt that the Afghan mission ended in failure. Afghanistan was the first country attacked by America as part of its so-called war on terror, launched by former President George W. Bush. Almost none of the stated goals of the Afghan mission were ever fulfilled. In late September, America's highest-ranking general, Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, said during a Senate hearing that the U.S. pullout, with the Taliban back in power, is quote-unquote a strategic failure.
America's weakness has been exposed to the world. I mean, essentially, America's incompetence, its military weakness, its lack of foresight was exposed as a result of the chaotic pullout of Afghanistan. America, it was shown that America had no idea why it was there. It had no clear goals. It lacked the military means for subduing the Taliban. And all it could do was spread destruction. So that is essentially exposes the incredible weakness of the American empire.
Many Americans are still looking for answers. What brought their country to this part of the world? And what kept it fighting a futile war for two decades? Meanwhile, the U.S. is definitely not taking responsibility for the mess that it left behind in this volatile region as huge waves of Afghan refugees overwhelm neighboring countries and beyond. The United States has fought many wars during its history. Over the past decades, most U.S. military missions have been criticized for not going as planned. The Afghan mission became particularly notorious for lack of strategy and proper planning. U.S. lawmakers have launched a commission to study the Afghanistan fiasco. This week, the U.S. Congress voted to set up a commission to assess the failures during the 20-year war. The commission was part of an annual military package passed by the Senate on Wednesday after approval last week by the House of Representatives. The bipartisan commission on Afghanistan will have 16 members. It faces a deadline to issue an initial report within a year of its first meeting and a final report within 3 years. The legislation said, quote, "The commission shall conduct a comprehensive assessment of the war in Afghanistan and make recommendations to inform future operations with tactical and strategic lessons learned, including the impact of troop increases and decreases, and date certain deadlines." The congressional panel will also study George W. Bush's launch of the war, as well as American policy on Afghanistan in the years before the mission.
We can be rest assured it will be unperceptive, unanalytical, and unintelligent. That seems to be quite clear. The U.S. is incapable of learning. It's incapable of learning from its past mistakes. It's destined to keep on making the same mistakes over and over again.
The United States seems to be reflecting on its longest war months after the chaotic pullout. Will it learn from its long list of failures in Afghanistan?
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: خذ من الدنيا ما أتاك وتولى عما تولى عنك، فإن أنت لم تفعل فأجمل في الطلب.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "Take off the favors of the world, whatever comes to you, and keep away from what keeps away from you. If you cannot do so, be moderate in your seeking."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, we find in the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam a truly comprehensive and jami' comprehensive personality. We find that Imam Ali alayhi salam has certain opposing qualities which superficially would not mix with one another. For example, we have Imam Ali alayhi salam, who is the epitome and the summit of courage and bravery, an individual who does not fear anyone but Allah. On the battlefield, we find that this individual is like a roaring lion, as one of his titles or his nicknames is Asadullah, the Lion of Allah. But at the same time, we find that this is an individual who weeps profusely in the presence of Allah, an individual who shakes when he comes for his prayers, his salah. These different qualities, which superficially seem to not be able to come together in one individual, in the divinely appointed Imams, in Lady Fatima Zahra, in the Holy Prophet Muhammad, we see that these seemingly opposing qualities are in perfect harmony in these individuals, creating a perfect, harmonious, almost divine, if we could say, persona. Along these lines, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that an ascetic person, an abstemious person, in Arabic is known as a zahid, which comes from zuhud, or this refraining from the world, the materialistic world. He says that this ascetic person, this zahid person in this world, is one who, the more ascetic they become, this abstemiousness manifests itself in that person. In what way? In that the more they turn away from the world and they take distance from it. Meaning, the more an individual becomes an ascetic, the more an individual becomes a zahid, then this following quality manifests itself in them. And that quality is that they begin to turn away from the materialistic world and they begin to distance themselves from the materialistic world. Now here, this distancing from the materialistic world and this turning away from the materialistic world does not mean that we wear ripped shoes and we wear ripped clothes and, you know, we starve ourselves to death and you know, we live on the streets or we live under a bridge. No, this is not what is being said. In reality, turning away from the world and distancing yourself from the world and being far from the world has to do with the love of the world. This is a distancing of the heart from the world. So, for example, you can have, average clothes, and you can have average shoes, and you can have an average house, and you can have an average car, but don't fall in love with it. Don't be attached to it. Don't let these things come in the way of your obedience to Allah, right? So, for example, if you take this down the same path, I mean, a person who is incredibly wealthy most probably is attached to their wealth, right? And you have to be very careful when it comes to a materialistic world and when it comes to wealth. There are different factors, negative factors, which start to come into play, whether it is greed and pride and arrogance and jealousy, whether it's israf, extravagance, takabbur, pride. And sometimes this pursuit of wealth can lead you towards haram, the forbidden things that Allah has made forbidden. It is a very thin line, a very thin line which one walks. But the core of the matter is to not fall in love with this wealth, to not attach ourselves with this wealth. And so the person who is truly an ascetic in this world, they might have the blessings of this world, they might have the bounties of this world, for surely Allah has created these bounties for His servants. But just because one has these bounties and thanks Allah for these bounties does not mean that one falls in love with these bounties and one gives away their heart to these bounties. A beautiful, profound, and lifelong lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
That's why that's the first important area in the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen that built his character, his initiative, his drive, and the Prophet's support from a young age that built the personality of the commander of the faithful. Similarly, what do you find? You find the Prophet of Islam, when he was about to leave towards Medina, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala revealed to him that there are people who are going to kill you, so leave. He informs Ali. The Prophet says to Ali, would you sleep on my bed? The Prophet is then set and told by Ali one thing, which is what? He says to him, Ya Rasulallah, awataslam, are you going to be saved? Is your life going to be protected? The Prophet said, yes. He said, then very well, I will do so. So he sleeps on the bed of the Prophet. And when the non-believers, they come to strike, they remove the cloth and they see Ali ibn Abi Talib at that moment. Question, did Ali know his life will be saved? Most likely no. Most definitely no, the ulama say. Because that would take away the merit. That would mean nothing. If the Prophet would say to him, by the way, and we don't have any evidence, by the way, that Rasulullah would say to Ali ibn Abi Talib, sleep on my bed and I guarantee that your life will be saved. Ali ibn Abi Talib said, I will give my life for your life, Ya Rasulullah. Because my concern is my faith. My concern is Islam. Above all, my concern is Allah. So I will give my life. And that's why Allah showed him off to the angels. The narration says, after he slept in the bed of the Prophet, Allah summoned Jibra'il and Mika'il, two angels, and says to them, who will sacrifice the life for the other amongst you? Both Jibra'il and Mika'il didn't want to. And Allah says, go down to the earth and protect my servant Ali. And say to him, what? You have tried to sacrifice your life for my servant Muhammad. They came, they descended. Amir al-Mu'mineen was on the bed, sleeping. They came next to him and said to him, Bakhin, Bakhin, Laka Ya Ali. Congratulations, O Ali. Who are saying? Jibra'il and Mika'il. وَقَدْ يُبَاهِي بِكَ اللَّهُ مَلَائِكَةَ السَّمَاءِ. Allah is showing you off to the angels of the heavens. That is a realization to start off with about the sacrificial nature of Amir al-Mu'mineen. What does that mean? That sacrifice from a young age, a youthful age, he still has all his life. He's not married, yes. He still hasn't seen. It was perhaps, if we talk about that he was 10, when he was 23 years of age, 22 years of age, he's still in the fruits of his youthfulness.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Monarchy is by definition incompatible with democracy. You cannot have a government chosen by election and at the same time have individuals occupying positions of power simply because they were born the sons or daughters of families who already have political power. It was on this principle that the English people fought a civil war, made a revolution, and cut off their king's head in the 17th century. When, after 10 years of being one of the first republics in the world, a monarch was restored to the British throne, it came to be understood that no king or queen would ever seek to rule without Parliament. Indeed, as Britain became a democracy, supporters of the parliamentary system insisted that the British monarchy has no real political power. The Victorian political theorist Walter Bagehot, for instance, wrote that the monarchy was merely a decorative part of the constitution and that real power was exercised by the cabinet. But even now, in the 21st century, is this really true? The royal family is, apart from anything else, and beyond dispute, very wealthy. And money is one sort of power.